Yes. Thank you very much. And I don't think I need to say very much about the why we want to know what the hell is blowing out. And I just have here a short quote from Mario Livio, who says that it's one of the most embarrassing things, the fact that we don't know what is going on. If you take everything into account, says Wolfgang Hillebrand, 1A's should not explode, actually. So both scenarios that we have, so single degenerate, double degenerate, all of them have some pros and cons, and none of them completely explains what we see. Of course, there are several ways that you would like to use to get some information about the progenitor. Well, I don't think we'll have never the possibility to see it directly, so you only have the chance to go through indirect ways. One of them, of course, and is the one that has been exploited so far, is through the interaction. So you have the supernova that explodes sometime, and then it does something to your environment, and then you try to look for some signatures, and then you interpret them in terms of the progenitor nature. So I will be very quick on this. We all know that no 1A has been ever detected in radio, and this is a very strong indication about the fact that the circumstellar environment cannot be so dense. There has been no detection of X-rays, at least not in any normal 1A. There was a very good candidate, actually, was 2005 KE, for which there was a 3.6 sigma detection, and while there was no radio detection, that was quite a bit suspicious, but after a reanalysis of the data, then nothing was found, actually. So we don't have not even that evidence. And also, in the optical, there is no narrow hydrogen or helium emission in any type 1A. Indeed, there are exceptional cases. We have already seen them. But first of all, well, the fact whether they are 1As or not, it's still debated. Second of all, they are rare. So they cannot account for for the bulk of the things that we see. So, well, the conclusion is that we can put some stringent limits, assuming a spherically symmetric steady wind, 10 kilometers per second, and as you can see, the limit is pretty stringent to the mass loss rate. So this already excludes some of the possible candidates. Another way of saying something about the progenitor's nature is studying the spectra, as Paolo Mazzali and Li Fan Wang, Gerardi, Kimby et al. Have done, actually. Studying, say, the profile of these high-velocity features that you, especially in the near-infrared calcium triplet. But as Paolo has shown, the interpretation is not unique. You can go through 3D effects and then you get the same. It's a very promising and interesting thing, but it's not the way. Another way that has been exploited, and I think is very successful and interesting and promising, is the observation of supernova remnants. Even in this case, you need though some interaction, so the supernova blows off and then it crashes into the pre-explosion material. It gives rise to some emission, and through the study of that emission, as Carlos has shown, then you try to say something about it. So, for example, in the case of the Kepler supernova remnant, the interaction, it's almost with a non-uniform CSM. Does that mean that you have a younger progenitor channel or a more massive progenitor? And then for most of the cases, then they have found that it's difficult to reconcile these very high velocity winds that you get from the white dwarf, which are foreseen by the models, with the fact that you don't see those big cavities around 1As. And then finally, I will be very quick on this because this has been discussed in detail by Dan Kazin this morning. You have the case for the entrained material, so the supernova explodes and brings with it some hydrogen, which you expect to see at later phases. As we all know, nothing has been found. And actually, this is something that, this is Craig Wheeler 15 years ago, and he's always the same, as you can see. So then after he will tell us how he manages to do that. I like to have him here, first of all, because he has invited me to this conference, and second of all, because when I started my master thesis from Professor Barbon, I got four papers. One was by Bob Kirchner, the other one was by Dave Branch, the third one was by Alex Filipenko, and the fourth one, of course, was by Craig Wheeler. So they have somehow doomed my career. So in a positive sense, of course. That was clear. So there's no detection, and this already rules out some of the possibilities. So I will just be very quick on that. As I said, this requires interaction, so you need the ejecta to crash into something. But this is a very interesting proposal that has been done by Ludwaysi and Sokolowski. If you have recurrent novae episodes before the explosion, well, very soon before the explosion, then they could excavate cavities, and so you will not have any interaction. So even though the material is there, it's too far, you will not see it with these methods. So the question was, are there any other methods? So, and now these are the ones that do not require interaction. This is a very interesting one, because it goes for the direct observation of the companion star. I will also be very quick here, so you have the double system, you have the explosion, then the companion star gets a kick, and you look for a fast star, which has been found by Pilar and collaborators, even though this has been, well, I wouldn't say questioned, but at least discussed about the fact that it's a non-rotating star, and then there are other problems. But certainly, this is applicable only to objects in our own galaxy. So it cannot give you, it doesn't have a statistical power, in a sense, even though it's very interesting and very promising as well. Then you have another thing, which I think is also very promising and interesting, is the direct observation of the progenitor system now. As we know, there might be cases where you have these super soft X-ray sources that come out from the accretion process from the companion star onto the white dwarf. And the bright idea by Voss and Nelemans was to look for archival images, to look for X-ray emission, and then see what happens after the explosion. If the emission is gone, then you have the proof that, well, you are rather confident that that was the guy that exploded. So this was the claim that they did. There was some reanalysis of the data. This is not yet, to me, not yet clear. I've been talking a lot with Voss about this. Not yet clear whether that was indeed a clear detection, because the target was still there. I think it decreased in magnitude by a factor of 3 or 4, something like that, but it was still there. But to me, this is a very promising thing. The limitation of this technique is that you need to have pre-explosion images in the archive. So it's a kind of a chance thing, unless you start a project and then you start monitoring or taking pre-explosion images of a lot of galaxies. But still, I think it's a very interesting idea. And then we came out with an idea, and as one of my collaborators said, when you have an idea, either somebody else had it already, or it's a stupid thing. Well, in this case, I don't know which one of the two it's true, actually, or both. Yes, that's also a possibility. And basically, this is the basic thing, that 1As are very UV deficient. You have, as Paolo Mazzali and Adi Paldra have shown, okay, this is a spectrum by Bob Kirshner, actually, 1992, and this is a model. As you can see, below, say, 2,000 angstroms, there is not very much. And this is due to line blocking by iron, cobalt, and all heavy stuff. So this is good in a sense, because the ionization flux is low. So the idea that came up was, why don't we look for neutral gas that would be ionized initially, but then it would start to recombine as soon as the supernova fades out. So the idea was, why don't we try to look for some absorption in some strong, very strong optical transitions, like the calcium HNK, the sodium D line, the potassium 1. Of course, if the gas is close to the supernova, it doesn't need to be very close, because you don't need to crash into it to see it. It's an absorption, and absorption is a very easy thing. You can be 100 parsecs away and still you have absorption. So, but if it's close enough, sooner or later, the ejecta would crash into it, and those lines should disappear. That was the basic idea. And I said, so let's wait for the next bright one, because you need to have a bright target. And that happens only once a year. So we were lucky. I don't know whether you can hear that. And this is... This is a cover version of Video Killed the Radio Star, originally by the Buggles. This is the cover version by the Cure, I think. And they say, and now I understand the supernova scene. How the hell they put in this text in the song, I really don't understand, unless one of them did a PhD in astronomy, which I doubt. But when... Was it the case? Yes, probably, yes. And he did a better job to leave astronomy because he earned much more money, actually. Anyway, the supernova blew up, and we started a campaign with UVAS, and actually we also got some data from our friends at Keck, and I will mention it later on. So this is 06X, is a very fast supernova. Actually, to my knowledge, is the fastest supernova ever. It's faster than O2BO, and actually faster than 84B, which was the fastest supernova ever seen before. So it reaches at minus 10 days, 20,000 kilometers per second. Well, is the deuced. You can see here the dotted line is 2002BO, and 06X is very fast. So we started immediately the campaign, and we got the first spectrum 2 days before. This is UVAS, the VLT, which gives you a resolution of 50,000, so 7 kilometers per second. It's a very high efficiency instrument. We could cover a number of phases, and we could complement them with a higher SKEC spectrum. You see the time that we have been investing. It's quite a bit, but I think it was rewarding. So the first thing that we saw, it was a very deep absorption at 75 kilometers per second from the rest frame of the galaxy. This is the sodium D1 plus D2 just on top of each other. This is atmospheric things. These are real things. The line is very strong and very saturated. And as you can see, you can also see at the same velocity calcium 2. But most importantly, you can see this CN band. This is the first time that was detected in a 1A, which means that there must be a very cold and very thick cloud in front of it. That's the supernova position, and if you go for the velocity map, and that's exactly 75 kilometers per second. So that feature arises in the disk of M100, the host galaxy. But this is not what is important. What is important is this, is the evolution. So you can see here minus 2, 14 days, 1461. And as you can see, there is a very clear evolution, without any doubt, in those features. They were almost absent in the first spectrum, but all of a sudden, 2 weeks after, then they show up, then there is an evolution here, an evolution here. So if you take this as the velocity at the explosion site, you have a range of 100 kilometers per second of features which change on time scales of a week or 10 days or so. So the first time we saw this, we said, okay, it's a geometrical effect. And this is easy to understand. This is the supernova, the photosphere of the supernova exploding. This is a cloud. There's no absorption. Then the supernova photosphere expands. Then you start intercepting part of the light, and you generate an absorption. Then at the stage when there's a complete coverage of the cloud, then the absorption is maximum. And then, of course, the cloud stays what it is. The photosphere expands, the covering factor goes down, and the absorption goes back. So lines are expected to appear and disappear. Even though this was never seen before, this must have been just a chance. And Einstein used to say that nature is subtle. I would use some more colorful expression here, actually, because we had that idea, we looked for the first target, and for the first supernova that we looked at, we saw the effect. And then we have never seen it again. No, that's not true, but I'll come back to that later on. So our interpretation was that these variations were due to the radiation field variations produced by the supernova itself. And that, of course, meant that the material was close enough to the 1A, and that meant that it was circumstellar material. So was a very exciting result. Of course, Nicolai has criticized, rightly so, I think, the model, saying that the things are not so simple. Our interpretation was a bit simplistic. It's difficult. You can ionize sodium. The problem is that sodium would stay ionized there for several months, so would never recombine, unless the density is very high. So you need an electron density of 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 electrons per cubic centimeter. So if any, this would say that it's not possible that this is produced within the wind of a red giant. It must be something else. Fine. So as I said, you can ionize sodium after, well, quite a bit. But the problem is that to have such high densities, then you need to ionize hydrogen. And you're not able to ionize hydrogen very far away because the flux is much lower at those wavelengths. So this confines the ionization of the material within 10 to the 17 centimeters, which I think is circumstellar. This is not the full truth. This is just an interpolation. You see that the lines appear, but then after a while, after a month, then they recede. So the scenario is a bit more complicated than I have depicted so far. So one possible explanation is exactly what we thought. Okay, you have the ionization, recombination, but at some point the ejecta reach that neutral material and they just sweep it away and the absorptions disappear. So based on this and on the time of the observation and the typical velocity, you can estimate the distance. And this is what turns out. So some of them must be around 10 to the 16 centimeters, and some others, not to be touched by the ejecta, by our own last spectrum, must be farther away, so say, of the order of 10 to the 17 centimeters. At that time, Chandra and Roger actually submitted a proposal for the VLA. We got the data, there was no detection. So if any, there is a very tiny amount of material, which is not surprising, because otherwise you would have seen through the emission lines. As I said, you have 100 kilometers per second here, spread of velocity. And then if you do your calculations, then you see that this material must have been ejected, if our interpretation is correct, of the order of 100 years before the explosion. So there's no way, well, there's no way, now we'll see. This, at that time, this is what we wrote in the paper, in the science paper. This rules out DD double degenerate for 06X. Thank you. But, of course, not for other objects. When the paper came out, though, Tutukov wrote me and he said, I'm very happy about your paper because it proves that double degenerate still works. So, and this is sociologically very interesting because it's a different interpretation of the same data. He said that that can be the trace of the common envelope. This requires a bit of fine-tuning, but this is just to show you how things go. So what's the companion of 06X? Well, if you put everything together, then our conclusion was that it was a white dwarf plus a red giant, okay, for this particular case. The fact that Nicolai said that it cannot be a spherically symmetric thing, it must be something else, goes together with the fact that if you look, for example, if this is due to the remnant shells of recurrent novae, for example, and you look at Arezzo Fiucchi, you see that this is not spherically symmetric, it's bipolar, actually. These are the pictures published by Bode et al. So we looked at the data, actually, there were archival data for Arezzo Fiucchi in an ISO archive, and they said, two high-resolution spectra taken, well, just after the outburst and 12 days after, the red one. And this is a sodium line, so this is the local spiral arm, other clouds. But there is a feature which changes in the same way as we saw in 06X. The difference is that, of course, the nova goes 10 times slower than a supernova, and the observation is one day after the outburst, while in the case of the supernova is 10 days after. So the scales that you are probing here are much, much smaller, most likely 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14 centimeters. But this is the proof that there is material, what we call circumbinary material, much closer. In the case of the supernova, to see that, you would need to observe in high resolution 15 days before maximum, or 18, well, very close to the explosion time. And actually, this is what Bob Williams et al. Have proposed when they saw our paper. Okay, I hate this, but I think I need to mention that it has been proposed that 06X belongs to a separate class. Of course, when you have different features, you invent a new class. So it has CSM detection, if you believe it. It has very fast expansion velocity, is a strong and weird reddening low. As you can see, you have this CN band, which is, well, rather unusual. And then this is the polarization low. You're going to see it as soon as the referee, who is probably present in this audience, accepts our paper, which is still hanging around, partly because of my fault. And there is a light echo detection. So all of this, Wang et al. Said, it points to a young population, which might be true. And also, they said it could be the short delay channel. Interestingly so, and this is, and now I'm close to finish, Simon, Josh Simon, has detected another similar case. This is also, it's 2007 LE. It is a fast 1A, so then the question is whether they indeed form a class. So this is the example. You see this is the D1 and D2 lines, and this is the feature that changed with time in a similar way. Something that I didn't mention is that this feature changes with time, but the calcium HNK don't. And that is how we ruled out the geometrical effect. Nicolai has an explanation for that, which I think we all agree, we agree with Nicolai, that this requires some ad hoc configuration. You need a cloud which has all the calcium depleted on dust grains, but still you need to have another cloud at the same velocity which produces that feature and is not associated with a supernova. So you can explain that way, it's a bit unlikely. And in this case, we observe exactly the same, which makes it even more unlikely. So we are the only explanation we have for this is that this is due to the radiation field of the supernova, and this is due to material close to the supernova. So, okay, we have studied a few others, and actually we find something like 1 over 6. By chance, this is exactly what you would expect if there is a torus, like Arezzo Fuchi around the supernova. So you would see those features only when you look close to the equatorial plane, and when you're far from the equatorial plane, you don't see anything of it. So indeed, the viewing angles might play a role. So our work has stimulated some more work, but it's clear that more work needs to be done. And right now we are, the science case is for the, it was inserted in the list for ESPRESSO. ESPRESSO is a high resolution spectrograph which is going to be mounted at the VLT at a combined focus in an incoherent way so that we have the equivalent of a 16 meter telescope. The idea is to go for exoplanets, of course, but we will use, this much more sexy than supernovae nowadays, but the idea is that we will use some time to do that. And we also managed to have this inserted in the science cases for CODEX, which is this very high resolution, very stable spectrograph that is going to appear at the ELT if this will ever see the light. Thank you very much. I just leave you with my... Yes, I would like just to leave you with my friends here, because I own them most of what has been done. So.
Do you see the same effect in the potassium lines? Because they have a moderate ionization potential in between the two.
We started with that was exactly the idea, that we started observing the potassium lines. The problem is that they fall in a region which is full of atmospheric absorptions, and we detected it only in one case, and that was only associated with a strong absorptions that you get from the disk or from the galaxy, and everything else is lost in the noise. Yeah. But that was exactly the idea that we had. We gave up.
Your idea of the torus is very interesting, because what happens when you see...
It's not mine.
Okay. The idea of the torus, yes, is very interesting, which you presented here. When we look at other galaxies at X-ray wavelengths, we see far too few supersoft sources to be consistent with the conjecture that you have, that the single degenerate channel could really be the way that most of the type 1a supernovae are formed.
Yes.
There has to be something which brings down the number that we can see by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. The more you can bring them down, the better, actually. absorption, of course, is one possibility. There are lots of problems with that. But if there's absorption which has the geometrical property of being able to block the sources completely in some direction, but allow some of the soft radiation out in others, that could be part of the solution. So there, and this could in fact be the case for some of the systems that are just like the ones you seem to be finding. So I don't know that there really is any meaning between the fact that these are consistent with each other, but to me it seems like it's potentially useful and worth following up.
Thank you.
Ask me, take over. Go ahead. So, very nice. I just wanted to add that in the last paper with Josh Simon, and that Nando and most of that team is also on, we have also detected H alpha at the location of the supernova, which appears to be variable. It's very, very weak. So we're not 100% certain that we can associate it with the supernova, rather than with the background H2 region, even though it does appear to change with time, and we are trying to verify that still. But it's at the level that you would have expected, because this material does have hydrogen in it, so in principle you should also see H-alpha. It's also just very weak.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I forgot that. I think this is the detection so far for hydrogen. Anything else is in normal 1As, is not real. Yes.
Just a small comment. It's probably completely our own fault, but there seems to be a lot of confusion about this 2007 ON. It actually is not there anymore after the supernova, but the limit is very weak. And there's another problem that actually the best X-ray position is not the same as the optical
right.
position.
Yes.
But X-rays is weird. There's only 14 photons, so it's quite difficult to make an accurate position. But it's unclear whether it was the progenitor or not. I think that's the thing that is certainly clear.
Yeah, thank you for making that clear. I still think that it's a very promising thing. You should keep doing it, actually.
Yeah, we're actually waiting. I wrote a proposal saying that this should happen about once a year, but since December 2007, it hasn't happened. So we're just waiting.
Yes, thank you.
Well, this is just another comment related now to this. Right now, if you look at about 340 some odd galaxies that have been looked at by Chandra, we now know of hundreds of supersoft sources. So in fact, there are lots of pre-observations that exist that could potentially find this. And in some cases where we don't know of a source today, it could be just that there were too few photons to call it a significant detection. But if you went back, you would see an excess maybe at the 2 sigma level. How you interpret that, I don't know. But there was another idea that we pursued some years back, which is that supersoft sources ionize the ISM around them and create these big nebulae that Alicia alluded to earlier today. And one idea that we had is that you might be able to find these nebulae if people have done O3 surveys, like Robin Ciardullo, for example, who's looked for planetary nebulae in lots of galaxies, that you may find at the site of one of these an unusual type of nebula that was there before the explosion. And again, that hasn't proved fruitful so far, but I don't think it's been pursued aggressively.
Would the nebula be visible against the supernova spectrum, and against that very bright light of the supernova?
Well, I'm not sure. It could be
I don't see any more hands. Thank you very much.
Thank you.